Okay, so this is week 12 on the Ten Commandments class. This week we're looking at the eighth command, which is the rule of property. So they're getting shorter and shorter. So this is Exodus chapter 20, verse 15. Good morning. And Exodus chapter 20, verse 15 says, "You shall not steal." You shall not steal. This is the rule of property. So here's the big idea that I have for this morning's class. The eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal, mandates that we labor honestly for private property. I didn't put that down right. Private property, and protect and promote that of our neighbors. Eighth commandment mandates that we labor honestly for private property and protect and promote that of our neighbors. So first, I just want to spend the first few minutes just kind of justifying that big idea. So what is meant by private property, first of all? Those two words. Private property. Now, interestingly, that's actually kind of a redundancy there, kind of like the phrase absolute sovereignty or free grace. Private property is redundant by putting those two words together. Private means belonging to oneself, not public or pertaining to the state. While property also means the right to possess, use, and dispose of something. It's ownership. The eighth commandment by itself, "You shall not steal," proves that the right to private property is a decree of God. It's not something that society has made up. It is a decree of God. G.I. Williamson in his book says this, quote, "If it were not so, the law would not say, 'You shall not steal.' For how could anyone steal if men did not have the right to private property? You cannot steal something from a person unless that thing rightfully belongs to that person." So private property is not something that God merely allows in culture. It's something that He mandates in culture. You shall not steal. Okay, so one of the things I want to do right away, though, is show that this idea of private property contains two important elements that we can't put aside. First of all, there is an element of horizontal ownership. I'll write this. So, first of all, this element of horizontal ownership. Person to person ownership. The idea of horizontal ownership is probably the most obvious aspect of private property entailed in the definition I just give. All I mean by it is that human beings have belongings or property that others do not have the right to without their consent. God ordained this in order to say something about Himself. And we need to ask ourselves, what does private property say about God? Well, as image bearers of Him, we have specific spheres of ownership that we have dominion over. And this reflects God's dominion over all the earth. So without private property, you can't reflect that particular aspect of God's glory. Earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. Thomas Watson said regarding the eighth commandment, "Property must be respected. God has set the eighth commandment as a hedge about man's estate, and this hedge cannot be broken without sin. If all things be common, there can be no theft, and so this commandment would be in vain." So as image bearers, we reflect God's glory in this particular way, namely, that we have dominion over these spheres that God has put us in control over. But the second idea that we can't leave on the table is the idea of vertical stewardship. vertical stewardship. By vertical stewardship, I just mean that God is the one whose property we hold on to. In reality, we are not owners ultimately, but stewards. Deuteronomy 10:14, "Behold, to the Lord your God belong heaven and the heaven of heavens, the earth with all that is in it." So God gave human beings private property, not so that we could consume it upon our own private pleasures, but rather so that we could love our neighbor as ourselves with these things. Jesus interpreted the second table of the law, remember, by the second greatest command. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Mark 12:31. So you can't obey the eighth commandment if you only see private property in this command without this element. You can't obey the eighth commandment if you don't see this element of vertical stewardship in it. Paul himself also expands this same idea. We're going to see this in a couple weeks in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28. He says this, "Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his hands, so that he may have something to share with anyone in need." So Paul's saying, don't steal, do honest work, all to the end of, or so that you can share with those who are in need. That's why God has given private property ultimately. It's to glorify Him in another specific way that horizontal ownership doesn't. So consider Luke 12:16-21. So here's a parable about a man who had private property but did not have this element of vertical stewardship in it. So Luke chapter 12:16-21. Jesus says this, "The land of a rich man produced plentifully. And he thought to himself, 'What shall I do? For I have nowhere to store my crops.' And he said, 'I will do this. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Relax, eat, drink, be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul is required of you. And the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God.'" So without this second element of property, of vertical stewardship, we will be undone. So to summarize real quick on just this first point, private property imaged forth God's glory in two particular ways. Horizontal ownership, we reflect God's dominion back to Him. And in vertical stewardship, we reflect God's generosity back to Him in the way that we deal with others. So both of those aspects say something about God. All right, so the question is now, is how do we obtain private property? How do we obtain it? I think there's three basic ways. Actually, there's lots of ways that the world says that we can obtain it. But the question is are those ways just ways? Because if we're interested in following God's commands, the way to get private property must be just. So way number one that we obtain private property is through inheritance. Father has goods and wills them to his family or friends when he dies. That's one way to obtain private property. The second way that we obtain it is through gifts. Gift giving and gift receiving are not merely allowable by God, but rather it encompasses part of what it means to be a Christian. So inheritance, gifts, and then thirdly, we can justly acquire private property through honest labor. And notice that adjective there, honest, Labor is not enough. It must be honest labor because you can acquire private property unjustly if your labor is corrupted. To step outside of those... it's possible that there might be another way to obtain it that I haven't thought about. But and if so, great. Let's throw them up there. But I think, generally speaking, to step outside of those broad, overarching categories is to step beyond our bounds onto God's property. Calvin says here, quote, "For we must consider that what each individual possesses has not fallen to him by chance, but by the distribution of the sovereign Lord of all. And no one can pervert his means to bad purposes without committing a fraud on a divine dispensation." Stealing is the fruit of a covetous heart. It is the fruit of a heart that is not satisfied with the boundaries that God has set. Consider the first sin that was committed in heaven. Satan coveted God's glory. He sought to steal it. And as a result, he was kicked out of heaven. Consider the first sin on earth. Of course, Eve had an inordinate desire within her, but what did she do before she ate the fruit? She had to steal the fruit. So Genesis 3:6. Consider the first sin that the children of Israel committed when they came into the land of Canaan. The first recorded sin. Achan, he stole forbidden goods that the Lord had put a ban on. And as a result, it cost him his life. Joshua 7:21. Lastly, consider the first recorded sin that the new church in Jerusalem recorded. In Acts chapter 5, Ananias and Sapphira stole from the portion that they said they gave to the Lord. They committed fraud. In each of these cases, death occurred because death is the just reward of thieves. So it's no accident. Who did Jesus hang between on the cross? Two thieves. So let's consider today, this morning, the ways that theft occurs so that we will not be guilty of dishonoring our Christ. Okay, so I have three spheres in which I want to apply this to. So first of all, stealing within the sphere of society. So in this first section, I just have in mind private citizens. Next, we see stealing within the sphere of the state. And there I have in mind both our actions towards the government and the government's actions towards us. And then thirdly, stealing within the sphere of the sacred. And there I have in mind the individual's responsibility toward God and the church. All right, so first of all, stealing within the sphere of society. Stealing within the sphere of society. So, we can steal from our neighbors when... I'll just say, we steal from our neighbors when... Point number one, we commit fraud against them. Fraud is a form of theft. It's not less stealing because it comes in a different form. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 23. Unequal weights are an abomination to the Lord, and false scales are not good. So, I remember the first time I read verses like that, it's a bit foreign to me because we live in a modern society, but consider pre-modern society where precious metals and goods were weighed in scales with preset measurements in order so that you and I could barter. Now, if someone had false weights or false scales, they could effectively plunder the goods from their fellow man. So in our culture, this would translate to something along the lines of false advertising. The promising of a product that doesn't correspond with the reality of it. Any false advertising that happens in our land? That's an attempt to steal from you. Or it's the purposeful withholding of information about defects about this particular product or this good, either by deceit or by silence, in order to sell it to the buyer at a higher price. That's stealing. Or it's a salesman or a tradesman. I'm sure you've never seen this before, Arnie, Mr. Painter, right? Salesman or a tradesman upping their prices when they think they have a sucker on the line or a rich person on the line. I'm not implying that you do that. I'm just saying, sure, you've seen that in the circles that you run in. Or it's a borrowing and not paying back promised money or goods, regardless if there was a good intention at the beginning to pay them back. A failure to not pay back is stealing. And this, you know, I think under this particular one, this is especially tempting to do when the person that has lent the goods or given the goods over to another person to be paid back in a later time is wealthy. Because sometimes the individual can reason, well, that person's wealthy and they don't need the goods. They won't be at a loss if I don't pay them back. That justification simply will not work. The command does not say you shall not steal unless the person you're stealing from is rich. There's no Robin Hood clause in the Eighth Commandment. Contrary to some popular opinion, on the other hand, it's also not okay to steal if you're poor. Proverbs 30, verse 8 and 9. This is Agur, he penned this prayer to God. He said this, "Remove far from me falsehood and lying. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is needful for me, lest I be full and deny you and say, 'Who is the Lord?' Or lest I be poor and steal and profane the name of my God." Stealing, even if one is poor, is profaning the name of God. So, I think the antidote for this is be like Agur here in Proverbs and pray for those things that are needful, lest you fall into sin with that covetous eye. So first of all, we steal from our neighbors when we commit fraud. Secondly, we steal from our neighbors when we commit carelessness towards our neighbor's belongings. We steal from our neighbors when we commit carelessness toward our neighbor's belongings. And I think that this comes in two different ways. It either comes through acts of commission or acts of omission. So first of all, by an act of commission, I just mean something that is performed intentionally, an intentional wrong act. So in the context of the Eighth Commandment, this would look something like a purposeful carelessness towards our neighbor's belongings. And by neighbor, I mean broadly, like the way that Jesus meant it. Anybody here. So, just an example. Renters who damage property that they are leasing out are stealing from those that they are renting from. In other words, any type of vandalism is stealing because you're forcing the person you are vandalizing to use other resources to repair the damages. And Absalom was guilty of this when he lit Joab's field on fire. That's stealing when you're purposefully careless towards your neighbor's property and not treating it as your own. But we can also be careless towards our neighbor's property by acts of omission. By acts of omission. So an act of omission is failing to do something that is required. It's not purposely doing something wrong. It's failing to live up to God's standard. So if you are in possession of your neighbor's property and you neglect to take care of it as your own, you're violating the Eighth Commandment. Or if you see your neighbor's property being abused by another person and you remain silent, you're violating the Eighth Commandment. Or if you accidentally damage your neighbor's property and then fail to compensate them for those damages, it's a violation of the Eighth Commandment. Under this point, it's important to point out that you can also be careless towards your neighbor's person, not just their belongings, but their person. If you see your neighbor in need and you fail to assist him and to promote his welfare when it is within your sphere and your means to do so, it's a violation of this command. Philippians 2:4 says this, "Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others." This is especially true. Paul's speaking to believers here, and we can see this same type of spirit in the Old Testament. Leviticus 20, verse 35. "If your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner, and he shall live with you." Now, I'm not going to expand this point. I do want to point out that I would suggest reading our Mercy Ministries paper to get a fuller view of what this would look like, because there's proper guidelines to showing mercy to people. So these commands weren't spoken in a vacuum. So if you're listening, just go to www.thewellboise.com, click on Resource Library, and then Articles, and you should be able to find the paper on Mercy Ministries. All right, so still on this point of stealing within the sphere of society, let's move on to employees. So employees can steal when, first of all, they don't complete the job which they've been contracted to do and which they've been compensated for. So think maybe more of a subcontractor, maybe not so much an hourly person, but this happens very frequently in the trades where I've come from. A contractor gets paid for a finished product, but it never gets finished. A punch list that you never go back and do. That's stealing because you were contracted to do the whole job. These points are shorter. Secondly, employees can steal when they abuse the tools and or equipment of the employer. And if you're working for the state, this is no different, because your employer at that point is the people and whoever else. So when employees abuse the equipment of their employer, they're effectively stealing from them, because it will result in the untimely demise of such equipment, which will cost the employer undue money. Abusing equipment or tools is theft. Thirdly, employees can also be guilty of theft when they don't work for the agreed to amount of time. When they don't work for the agreed to amount of time. So laziness at work is theft. The only way to positively obey the Eighth Commandment is to stay on task and act as if you are working for the Lord. Because, in fact, that is who you are working for. Ephesians chapter 6, 5 through 8 says this, "Bondservants, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart, as you would Christ. Not by the way of eye service, as people pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord, and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is a bondservant or is free." So if we want to be not in violation of the Eighth Command in our work time, we need to work and stay on task diligently. But we can also see that employers can steal. Employers steal when, I think just one point under this particular point is that they steal when they fail to give fair wages. And I'm not using that word fair the way that it's been defined by our modern culture. What I mean something very specific. Oftentimes in work environments, relationships can be used as a means to manipulate employees, to cheat them from paying them fair wages, either by making promises and then breaking them about when wages will be increased, or kind of failing to stay within those market standards. And you're using the relationship in order to withhold due wages. This is stealing. Employers need to remember that they are stewards over the employees that God has working for them. Ephesians 6:9. So this is Paul finishing up talking about masters and servants that we just talked about a second ago. Masters, do the same to them, that is, your employees, and stop your threatening, knowing that He who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and that there is no partiality with Him. Additionally, Proverbs 3:28 says, do not say to your neighbor, go and come again tomorrow. I will give it then, when you now have it with you. That's a way to manipulate from keeping wages on people, at least in that particular application. So just like the other commandments that we've already looked at through this class, the eighth commandment is exceedingly broad. Calvin summarizes this section by saying this, quote, the violation of this command is not confined to money, to merchandise, to lands, but it extends to every kind of right. For we defraud our neighbors to their hurt if we decline any of the duties which we are bound to perform toward them. Remember, Jesus interpreted the second table of the law by loving your neighbor as yourself. So part of the eighth commandment is that we are to protect and promote our neighbor's private property. All right, so next. Stealing within the sphere of the state. Stealing within the sphere of the state. So, point number one, I'm just going to apply this to us. We steal from the state when, number one, we refuse to pay taxes. Most obvious one, paying taxes is a just and right thing to do, and in fact, it is ordained by God. Romans chapter 3, verses 6 through 7 says this, for because of this, you also pay taxes. For the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed to them. Taxes to whom taxes are owed. Revenue to whom revenue is owed. Respect to whom respect is owed. Honor to whom honor is owed. Now, notice how many times it said owed in that particular passage. Three times, in fact, regarding to the reference of taxes. Taxes are owed, meaning they are obligatory for us to pay, because that is the way that God has designed things. So to not give them to those who it is due is to steal from God who has put them in authority. We also see that in these verses that we have a duty to honor and respect these offices. And if we don't do that, we're stealing. The offices is what I mainly mean here. Which I know is not completely disconnected from the person, but I believe that's what God had in mind primarily. If that office bearer is not respecting His office, then there are means that God has given for us to remove them. Okay, so paying taxes is also something that is modeled to us by Jesus Himself. Mark chapter 12, verse 14 through 17, Jesus was asked this, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay them or should we not?
But knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, "Why put me to the test? Bring me a denarius and let me look at it." And they brought one, and he said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" They said to him, "Caesar's." Jesus said to them, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And they marveled at him. Now, if we try to justify not paying taxes because our particular government is evil, this will not work. Jesus commanded that tribute to be paid to Caesar in spite of the wickedness of Rome. Remember, they crucified people on the street. And Jesus still said, "Render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar." So a failure to do so is disobedience and theft. Now, footnote. There may be other theological and socio-political considerations at play in a particular context. The command to pay taxes remains in place even if there comes a time when one transfers paying those taxes from one government to another. For instance, the Revolutionary War was just even when they stopped paying taxes to England and started paying them to the new established government. The point remains in either case is that God commands us to pay taxes to those servants, and if we don't, then it is stealing. All right, so still within the sphere of the state, now we look to the second point, which is, sorry, not A2, but B. The state steals when? Now, if I was going to be exhaustive in this particular list, it would be so long it would exceed the tax code that the IRS specifically has, but I will try to just do one particular application. The state steals from its people when it collects taxes using different weights and measures. State steals when it collects taxes using different weights and measures. It's the same phrase I used earlier, Proverbs chapter 20, verse 10. Unequal weights and unequal measures are both alike an abomination to the Lord. So what the U.S. government does with our taxes, whether they're Republican or Democrat, if they use unequal weights and unequal measures, it is an abomination, the Lord says. That's strong language. That's the same type of language that God uses to condemn homosexuality. An abomination. The U.S. government uses unequal weights and measures when applying the tax code to the American people. The so-called marginal tax rate taxes the rich at a higher rate, which is what the scripture calls unequal weights and unjust measures, than it does the poor. And this is all done in the name of fairness. Fairness. There's the million-dollar word. So-called fairness is what drives the lunatics in this country to come up with things like Obamacare, the death tax, forced minimum wage. And this is what the world calls fairness, but this is what the Bible calls stealing. Point in case is a conversation that happened during the 2008 presidential debates on the topic of the capital gains tax. In his book, Politics, Wayne Grudem reports the following, quote, "When presidential candidate Obama was asked during one of the 2008 debates, he affirmed his conviction that his idea of fairness would still be a reason to raise taxes even if it meant collecting less tax revenue for the government." So I'm going to raise taxes even if it means we're going to get less money. In the April 17th, 2008 presidential debate, ABC News' Charles Gibson cited the fact that when the capital gains tax rate dropped from 28 to 20% and then to 15%, revenues from the taxes increased. But in the 1980s, when the tax was increased to 28%, the revenues went down. So, Gibson asked candidate Obama, quote, so why raise it at all? Especially given the fact that 100 million people in this country own stock and would be affected. Obama replied, well, Charlie, what I've said is that I would look at raising the capital gains tax for the purpose of fairness. Fairness. By fairness, he means the redistribution of wealth. He meant socialism, which inevitably leads to communism. And this is breaking the Eighth Commandment on steroids, and it is grounds for throwing off the shackles of tyranny and forming a new government. The Founding Fathers put up with much less than this when the Revolutionary War began. This type of theft puts all of society's life, liberty, and property at risk, and this is only one of the commandments that our government violates. Not even to mention the Sixth Commandment. I would just say one thing for those who would object and say, well, this is what the people want. The people want this type of redistribution of wealth. They want this type of government. Redistribute the wealth, tax the rich, give to the poor. And in addition, somebody might say, well, this is what the American people consent to. And if someone were to bring that objection, I would say, so what? Even if a whole society consented to this type of mutual theft, it does not make it right. Theft, adultery, lying, murder, dishonoring parents are not okay things to do, even if the parties involved consent to the mutual abuse of one another. So let's apply this now to the Fifth Commandment. Honor your father and your mother. If my son is dishonoring me and I'm taking it, and I'm consenting to this him dishonoring me, that does not make it okay. Mutual consent does not make the violation of the command all right. So even if a whole society mutually consented to having socialism be their form of government, that would still be wrong. Because God is the one that commands this. Our obedience is to Him primarily. That's why the first table is the first table and the second table is the second table. All right, lastly, stealing within the sphere of the sacred. Stealing within the sphere of the sacred. So, we're going to look at three basic ideas here. So we can steal time from God. Those three famous T's, right? We can steal time from God. We can steal talent from God. And we can steal treasure from God. Recall Psalm 24:1, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and those who dwell therein. First of all, just this idea of time. Time. The time that we live in, the time that God has given us to occupy, does not belong to us. Every second belongs to the Lord. So I want to apply this in two ways, both first generally and then more specifically. So in the general category, the idea of idleness. Idleness. Idleness is an idea that is long lost on not only the American people, but it's also been stripped away from the consciousness of even many of our religious institutions. Idleness is treating time like it's your own private property, and not something that the Lord has given you to steward. So, strictly speaking, idleness is a state of doing nothing in particular. It is neither working, laboring out there, nor is it engaging in the Lord's business. It's doing nothing. And where did we get the idea that idleness is okay? Well, it's bred in us. Every time we sit down and watch TV, it's communicating these ideas to us. And that's stealing from God. Proverbs 18:9 says this, whoever is slack in his work is a brother to him who destroys. Ecclesiastes 4:5, the fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. And what we see is that this particular sin is often punished by the multiplication of other sins. Thomas Watson says this, quote, "The devil hires such as stand idle, and he puts them to a pilfering trade. An idle person tempts the devil to tempt him." Most of our many of our calamities that we experience in life happen as a result of us being idle at that particular time. And we find ourselves engaging in sin that we wouldn't have been if we weren't robbing time from God. That's the general application of stealing time. The more specific application of stealing time is in the Sabbath command. We looked at this for 3 weeks, so I won't labor this point here. But God gives us the proper pattern for work and for rest. And if we try to forge our own way and rest when we should work, or work when we should rest and worship, we're stealing from God. And I'm not speaking about vacations, just like I said in the class, or things of that nature. Those are good things that God encourages us for our good. I'm speaking about the normal rhythm of work and worship that God has established. The Sabbath is to be kept holy, and it cannot be when we are abusing the rhythm that God has established. Secondly, we steal in the sacred sphere when we steal talents from God. When we steal talents from God. Paul reminds us in 1 Corinthians 4:7, "What do you have that you did not receive?" What do you have that you did not receive? All of our personal gifts, all of our talents that God has given us are to the purpose of edifying the church and glorifying God. And if we refuse to use them for that specific end, we become like that unfaithful steward who steals from his master in Matthew 25:19-26, where we hide that talent in the ground. If you hide the talent in the ground, you're stealing from God. Even if at the judgment you give the full talent back to Him. That Jesus didn't accept that, did He? No, God gave it to us so that we could go public with it. And if we refuse to go public with those particular gifts that God has given us, that's stealing. Because your talents are not your own property. You're a steward of them. Lastly here, this last section is we can steal treasure from God. We can steal treasure from God. I'm only going to apply this in the area of visible treasure. There's a way you can steal invisible treasure, which I will probably get to next week. Visible treasure. First of all, Proverbs 3:9 says this, "Honor the Lord with your wealth and with the first fruits of all your produce." So God has provided wealth for many different reasons for us. But the chief reason for which He created it for us for is so that we can glorify Him with it. God wants us to honor Him with our wealth, with the first fruits of all our produce. And failing to do so, failing to honor Him like that, is robbing from God. The New Testament furthermore tells us that what God wants from us is to be a cheerful giver. 2 Corinthians 9:7. If our hearts are not cheerful when we give to God, then we are robbing Him primarily of the devotion that He deserves. He's after our hearts. If we are pursuing Him in our hearts, we will be pursuing Him with our treasure. Jesus said in Matthew 6:21, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." But there is a way where we can deceive ourselves into thinking that we are giving to God if we offer Him an artificial sacrifice. An artificial sacrifice. When we give offerings only because it's convenient for us, even if we're doing it cheerfully, we are not honoring Him with our wealth. Instead of giving sacrificially, we're actually giving artificially. And the ancient church was guilty of this. Malachi 3:8-10. God specifically says, "Will man rob a God?" Rob God, sorry. "Yet you are robbing me. But you say, how have we robbed you? in your tithes and contributions. You are cursed with a curse, for you are robbing me, the whole nation of you. Bring the full tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and thereby put me to the test, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open up the windows of heaven for you and pour down for you a blessing until there is no more need. The ancient church was robbing God because they were only giving when it was convenient to them. They weren't giving sacrificially, but artificially. And that kind of giving is robbing. I'll close here. I want to contrast two different ideas when it comes to this idea of robbing treasure from God from two different places. I'm not going to quote them. I'm just going to summarize. Consider, first of all, the widow that gave her mite. And Jesus considered what she gave to be a great thing because she gave all that she had. It was a mite. It's like a quarter of a penny or something crazy small like that. So it was is literally almost nothing. On the other hand, consider the irony that surrounded the circumstances of Ananias and Sapphira, the way that they gave. They probably gave a considerable amount of money because they sold a piece of property. But they were committing fraud at the same time. They were giving artificially because they said they gave an amount which they did not give. And they were stealing, even though their amount was much greater than the widow's mite. And this illustrates the principle from 2 Corinthians 8:12, where Paul says this, if the readiness is there, it is acceptable according to what a person has, not according to what a person does not have. And so we're judged on whether or not we're stealing treasure based on what we have and what we are giving sacrificially. Alright, so there are probably more spheres that this eighth commandment could be applied to. That's where I'm going to stop today. So if you guys have any questions, I'd be willing to entertain them for a few minutes.
I think one of the areas that this could be applied to, and I can certainly see this in the society, is the area of authority. I think you can say that if we're not giving to God what is already His, we are undermining authority.
Mm-hmm.
We're not recognizing Him as our ultimate authority.
Right.
We're not giving our tithes.
Right.
We're saying God's authority is not ultimate.
Right.
It's not sovereign.
Right.
And I think, in another way of looking at it, exactly what you're saying is that each one of these things, we're not giving our neighbor just due.
Mm-hmm.
We're not respecting our neighbor. We're not respecting our employer. And so we're not recognizing their authority
right.
to be where they are by stealing from them.
Right.
And I think, from my perspective, that is one of the reasons why we're having a lot of problems in our society
mm-hmm.
in so many different ways. We don't respect the authority of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
We don't respect the authority of the state and our institutions. And I say that even from the perspective of a president taking office and not respecting the Constitution
right.
that has been set up as an authority
right.
over our country.
Right.
So I think authority is a big issue
yeah.
in the life of a believer. And missing that one point can dramatically alter their whole view
yeah.
of God, the Scriptures, and what God has called us to be.
I think what you're illustrating too is the way that the commandments work, first table, second table. This country is not in the hole it's in merely because we're violating the fifth commandment or the sixth commandment or the seventh commandment. We're in the hole that we're in because we're violating the first commandment and we have other gods before us. That's the authority that you're talking about. We've set up other gods, and you cannot disobey the first commandment without trickling down and destroying every other institution. It's impossible.
That's kind of the same point. else tiptoeing around subjects that involve undermining authority in the home and in the church.
Mm-hmm.
Will we laugh and joke and enable subordinates to steal from authority, not what we think of as their physical property, but their time, their speech in the classroom, cutting up in class, pastors, kids, TK, haha, let's giggle at that.
Right.
No, let's warn that you are a steward of your submission
right.
to this authority. That is property, and ultimately it's God's property.
Right.
And I was talking to you the other day about how sitcoms jokes about the male-female relationship.
Yeah.
It's really one of the central focuses of all comedies on TV for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
And anyway, it's funny. It's not funny, it's wicked, and it'll get you, in hell. And you can't argue to God on Judgment Day. I had a lot of pressure on me.
Yeah.
Deciding to say that I have a really fragile conscience as a result of being in this position. No. You're on a treasure ship, and you're in a war.
Mm-hmm.
God has placed you in this position to perform as a subordinate, honorably, with property that is not your own.
Mm-hmm.
People are watching, and people will be hurt as a result of their treating that as some other thing inside.
Right.
And we don't, there's no teaching of that in the church.
Yeah.
And that's a shame.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey Josh, I missed the first 15 minutes of class. Did you speak to how the rule of property is foundational to human rights?
Well, I briefly touched on the fact that this... I didn't specifically touch on that. I said that the Eighth Commandment, private property, is not something that society established on their own. The commandment itself, you shall not steal, implies... by invincible, necessary consequence that God is the one that established private property. This is not our stuff collectively, but this is your stuff. And I drew a couple arrows up there about this means horizontal ownership and then vertical stewardship. So I didn't touch on that specific point. Real quick too, though, there's a way that you can steal from God in your theology. And I didn't even touch that would have been the fourth T, so time, talent, treasure, and theology. And I just gotta say, I don't want you to hide behind this word as if I'm picking on them for no particular reason if you're listening. But Arminianism or any form of synergism is stealing from God. G.I. Packer has one of the best quotes on it, and I wish I just memorized it, but it's stealing from God because it takes due worship from Him and it puts it in the sphere of the human being. So your theology can rob God of the glory that's due Him. In 1 Timothy or 2 Timothy 1, I think, where it says, think hard after these things and the Lord will give you insight into them. If you refuse to think about theology, you are disobeying the command and you're stealing... you're stealing your mind away from those things that you should be applying them to, because that's the command. So that would be the fourth T that I'd apply it to, is theology. You can steal in the realm of theology. Even if you're giving time and talent and treasure, you could still be a robber of God.
And I think that verse itself, that is what you also mentioned with regard to works itself down into, you know, the first example I have in the military is, I've observed young men and women not rendering a salute to a senior. And I've stopped a few and said, I'm just a chaplain, but I'm asking about this because there's going to be a point in your life if you're not rendering that salute to the senior, that you're going to get caught.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be pretty.
Right.
And the statement that I've gotten back on numerous occasions is, well, I don't respect that person.
Right.
So I'm not going to give a salute. And my, obviously, again, authority comes up.
Mm-hmm.
But the rationale
right.
that lets them make that choice
right.
is that, I don't have to give honor to something that I don't agree with.
Right.
But that's also the whole idea behind Arminianism.
Right.
I don't have to give honor to what I don't agree with. That's what Arminianism is basically.
Yeah.
I don't agree that God is sovereign over my life.
Right.
Therefore, I will not give honor to a sovereign God.
Right.
Same.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you're doing that, you're not only violating the eighth commandment, but you're also violating the first commandment because you have a co-God on the throne. That co-God is yourself.
Just like the rule of authority, under your testimony, our father and mother, doesn't say, honor them if they're honorable.
Right.
It's just by their position, by their.
Yeah.
By who they are.
Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's a theology of civil, I guess it's like civil disobedience. Like even when in Acts 6 or whatever, when Peter and John were disobeying the state, they were doing it in a way where they were still honoring the office, but honoring God by their disobedience. And even with our government, I know I spoke not too harshly about them today, but I can still salute President Obama and try to, you know, not have him be elected again, ever.
Sure.
And get him out of office as quickly as possible. So. Right.
Right.
You know, and I think